Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Darren Lewis of the Daily Mirror and Dave Kidd of The Sun. They're too young to remember 1984. Honest. So, here's a quick history lesson. European Cup final, Rome. Roma won, Liverpool won. A penalty shootout. Bruce Grobbelaar's legs go all trembly. Francesco Graziani puts his penalty into orbit. Liverpool have their fourth title. Now, can they win it for the sixth time in Kiev next month?
I think they've got a great chance, Mike. I think there is a real momentum building within the club. They've lost only once since January. People talk about their defensive frailties. They've kept clean sheets in 9 of the last 15 games. They've got now the player of the year, PFA player of the year, in Mo Salah, who is just breaking all sorts of records. What's not to like about a side that lots of people derided early in the season, and now we're going to end up praising to the skies if they follow it through?
What do they need to take to Rome, Dave? You know, we talk a lot about, you know, the famous Anfield Nights. Yeah. Now, like most cliches, there's a bit of truth to that.
They do tend to perform on those European nights over the last few years. That Europa run they had to the final, there were some great nights there at Anfield. Same this time around with the Manchester City games, specifically a couple of weeks ago. So it's not just a myth. I think it does really seem to lift in the atmosphere there. I think any victory at Anfield, even if it's a 2-1 and a 3-2 with away goals for Roma, I'd still fancy Liverpool to see the job through with a draw in Rome. I think Roma are a very strong team, a very dangerous team, slightly underrated, but they are the team that Liverpool would have picked out of those three possible opponents. I think I would have just about fancied Real or Bayern over two legs to defeat Liverpool, but my money would be on Liverpool for the semi-final.
So my worry is that we may all, including myself, underestimate Roma. I certainly did earlier in the season when they played Chelsea in the Champions League.
Because they topped that group, Chelsea and that.
Very good.
Terrific group, exactly. In that game away, I expected Chelsea to go down and win. Chelsea got thumped 3-0. In the home game against Chelsea went 2-0 up. And we thought it was going to be how many, and they came back then. So it wasn't just about the comeback against Barcelona. This is a side, not only have they got the quality in Dzeko, they've got world-class goalkeeper Alisson, and they've got quality sprinkled all around the team, but they've got that will to win, the character that actually sees you through big European
and
nights.
Experience that midfield, Streetman, De Rossi, Nainggolan, the three of those are all really experienced campaigners. It's a good solid midfield.
And Dzeko as well. If you look
Dzeko
at him,
is an outstanding
player.
Been
playing for Chelsea, couldn't he?
Yeah, he could have done, and he'd have been a great signing for them. I know Giroud's done okay for them, but Dzeko was the one they really wanted. And it was quite heartening that they did stay, because I'm sure there'd be more money for him at Chelsea. But Roma have ambition and they have experience, they have quality. It's not going to be easy, but I do think that they'd rather have Roma than Bayern or Real. And you know, I think Liverpool should have enough.
Where are the weaknesses, do you think, Darren, within Liverpool? You know, is it, you know, you mentioned them, the Roma midfield, Dave. Have they got enough about them in midfield to actually counter that?
Possibly not. I think if there is going to be an area where they're overrun. You see, there is a lot of energy about Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. We were talking before we came on about the fact that lots of people have underestimated him in a big way when he was at Arsenal, and possibly through all this loving with Arsene Wenger, the progress that Oxlade-Chamberlain has made at Liverpool is an indictment of his time under Arsene Wenger, because he's really come on a bundle. But Can I just mention the experience and the legs and the know-how of the players in the Roma midfield? You've obviously got guys like Shaarawy as well, scored twice against Chelsea. He knows how to get forward and cause problems at the other end of the pitch. But De Rossi, who's an experienced campaigner, Perotti as well. I mean, I just wonder if they might have too much in that area of the field for Liverpool. As I said before, defensively, they're actually better than a lot of people give them credit for. Karius has improved as the season's gone on. I remember people having a go at De Gea when he first went to Manchester United. Now they're calling him world class. I don't think he would get to De Gea's level, but I think he'll certainly improve for his time in the Premier League already. And obviously we know what they've got up front. So if there is an area, I think it might well be midfield.
James Milner, a really important player.
Yeah, he was outstanding against Man City in that first leg, wasn't he? I thought the English trio in midfield were brilliant that night. Milner, the way he closed, I can't remember who he closed down, but he won the ball back for Oxlade-Chamberlain's excellent second goal. I thought, you know, we do actually say, and I know Milner's retired from international football, but we do talk about England really lacking, England's national team really lacking in central midfield quality. But then you look at those three in that game in particular, and you think, well, actually, you know, I mean, the Ox has improved massively at Liverpool, and it is an indictment of Wenger. Players haven't improved at Arsenal in recent years. They are improving under Klopp in the way that they've improved under Guardiola. So individual players are improving. Oxlade-Chamberlain, you know, he's always had goals in him, but his goals tally has always been poor. You know, he's always been able to score spectacular goals, occasional goals in big occasions, but not done it consistently. That's the next phase for him, is to be a consistent goal scorer. And that's what Klopp was saying after the first leg at Anfield against Man City. You know, he was actually quite critical of saying, you know, why doesn't he do it more often? Because he's got it in him. And that's what Klopp does. He pushes players in a way that Wenger in recent years, for instance, hasn't done.
But we have to talk about that Fab Three up front, don't we? You know, they've scored more goals combined than 14 Premier League clubs. They've scored 9 out of their 10 goals.
They were a Fab Four, and the most valuable of that Fab Four was sold in mid-season. Yeah. And that's how good the other three have been, you know.
In a weird way, I think the departure of Coutinho has actually helped the team. He didn't want to play for them. He wasn't committed. Klopp himself has said, what good would a player who wanted to protect himself, didn't want to get injured, be to us in the second half of the season? To get £142 million from his terrific business. But you look at the way they play now, the way they interchange, how selfless they are. I mean, you mentioned the three of them scored more than half the team. Salah scored more than Newcastle, I think. The guy is just a tour de force. And I don't think it's a freak season. He scored 19 goals for Roma last season. But now he's playing, and when he won the award, it was really key that he kept paying tribute to the team. It wasn't all about him. He kept talking about the team helping him to do what he has done. And I think he is going to go from strength to strength because he is surrounded by people who get the best out of his game. And to blitz City the way that they did, that tells you all you need to know about the goal-scoring power in that front three. And that's a big reason why I think they might edge it.
It's interesting, you know, reading in the Italian press that, you know, some of the Roma players are basically promising to beat up Salah, you know, their former teammate. Now, you can't question his character. You know, he's a guy who scored a last-kick penalty to get his country into the World Cup finals. How do you think he'll approach it?
Salah?
Yeah.
I think they, as a team, and Salah personally, will try and do to Roma as what they did in Man City. And I think in some ways, you know, we always talk, you know, traditionally about being away second leg being an advantage. I think Liverpool see being at home first leg as an advantage, and just if they can blitz a team like they did Man City, and if they can do it to Man City, they're capable of doing it to Roma. I think it will be, you know, going for the jugular. And he is a player who has that directness and can cut inside, and that's what he's all about. I think there'll be the same sort of positivity and energy about the place, and there'll be, you know, Liverpool will be going out there thinking we want to be two goals up at half time at least, and you know, grab this title.
Don't you think, you know, that the because of the way that they've come back against Barcelona, even a three-goal advantage, you still can't be confident, because we talk about big European nights at Anfield. Obviously, they've got big European nights over there as well that they've had. And so, from that point of view, that there can't be a complacency, even if they were to build up a decent... I mean, obviously, they smashed them up in the first leg, then, you know, 4-5-0, maybe you can start to get confident. But, you know, the Barcelona game shows that they are a side packed with character that will respond even if we get what we believe to be a healthy sort of 2 or 3 goal lead.
But one time Salah was really quiet recently, it was at Man United, when United beat them a month or two ago. I was at that game and you know, he was getting a lot of fanfare before the match. I myself was writing, comparing him to Messi. He hardly had a kick that day, you know.
Win some, lose some.
Well, he's got about another 15 goals in the last 6 games since or something. But yeah, I mean, United did keep him very quiet. You know, it can be done. He was very, very quiet that day.
But isn't that the joy of the Champions League, that the teams now at this stage are of such a high quality that if you drop 1%, you are in deep trouble?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it may well be that on that famous night where Roma pulled off probably one of the results of any season against Barcelona, it may well be that they did drop below their minimum standard, that they were possibly complacent, believing they'd done the job already. And, you know, you've got to talk about the elements within that side because, you know, Messi, Suarez, you know, I think the quality they had in that team, for Roma to approach it the manner that they did, will be a warning, if you like, to Liverpool. And, you know, Mike, I reckon, I know Klopp wasn't particularly happy at the weekend about the West Brom result. I think that might be a blessing in disguise because, you know, it will remind Liverpool that you've got to be on it, you've got to be on point, you've got to approach this in the right way. Let your guard down, you'll get hurt, and you'll miss out on possibly the best opportunity. Well, not possibly, it is the best opportunity that they've had to win the Champions League, a sixth European Cup, 4 years. And for many of these players, you know, will it come again? You know, because obviously he will perform surgery on that team and move some out and get more quality. And Naby Keita, of course, coming in the summer. So this is a golden opportunity that they've got to take.
If you look at the competition as it is now, it's now without Manchester City, double winners in England. It's now without Barcelona, just about to become double winners in Spain. You've got Bayern, another double winner, playing Real Madrid in the other game on Wednesday. What do you make of Bayern?
Yeah, I mean, Bayern are always there and they're always dominating in Germany, apart from actually Klopp's time with Dortmund. You know, they stroll the league, you know, these days. They're a very powerful unit. Heinkes is you know, he won the European Cup last time he was there. He's got a great chance of winning it again now. You occasionally wonder with Bayern whether they're pressed enough and they could be undercooked going into Europe, but that doesn't seem to be the case. They've been, you know, played well in Europe this season. In Lewandowski, they've got probably still best sort of out-and-out target man in world football, really. So, you know, they're always going to be tough opponents. And Real have not been Real this season.
Lewandowski is really interesting, isn't he? Because he's got himself a new agent, Pini Sahavi. Surprise, surprise, he's now being linked. Real Madrid.
And he was very strongly linked with Real Madrid 2 or 3 years ago, and he definitely is his ambition to play there. Knew somebody who was close to him in that era, and they were definitely trying to get that deal done. It never happened at the time. He's now touching 30. I think he's 30 this summer, Lewandowski, so certainly his last chance, if he's not too late, to make that move. And whether, you know, you wonder whether Real Madrid they clearly are looking for a number nine. Whether they might be looking for Kane, being that much younger than Lewandowski, would be the next one off the rank, I think. So it's interesting that they're trying to get that done. They might have impact on Spurs as well, actually.
Yeah, we'll talk about Spurs later. But actually, on Kane, you know, he doesn't look fit at the moment, which again, you know, we can maybe ruminate on later. But would he be the sort of player that would fit into a Galactico lifestyle?
That's really interesting and a great question because he's made it clear that as long as Spurs win things, he's prepared to stay where he is. He's from North London, not far from where I live, actually. Although I would imagine his house is a bit better than mine.
Of extra media, you do.
But I think as far as he is concerned, as a player, is that a club that are going to move into a new stadium? They've got Champions League football. They're meeting the requirements. Obviously, Bayern Munich coming in for you, the big clubs. When they come, it's easy to say you're not going to go until they come. And then when they come, it's a big decision for you to make. Could he fit into that kind of lifestyle? I don't see him as somebody who would let things get to him. He's been presenting celebrity awards or whatever else goes back, does his day job very well indeed, and on course for a third Golden Boot. Of course, Mo Salah ahead of him. I just think, in the short term, the key man for Bayern is Henkes. Because before his arrival, Carlo Ancelotti lost his job, Bayern all over the place. I think they won 7 out of 11 games. Willy Sanyol took over for a short period. Since Henkes has come back to the club, and Kiddo talked about the fact that he'd won the Champions League before, they've lost 1 out of 31 games. The run they've been on has been absolutely sensational. I think they've only drawn 2 or 3 of them. And the players are responding to him again. He's a guy who knows how to get his tactics right. He knows how to get the best out of the players. And I think that if there is somebody who is the key man in the game, obviously we know about all the individual elements, and Kiddo rightly mentions Lewandowski and his goal-scoring potential, but he is a man who knows how to get this Bayern team and the club over the line. And I think he could well be the reason, if they are to win it again, he could be the reason why.
It's an interesting, we're at the stage now where belief is absolutely total, has to be total. I read some stuff from Thomas Müller yesterday where he was talking about, look, there's something in the air here. We've got something. So when you've got that sort of intangible dimension to your play, it can be really dangerous, can't it?
Yeah, and Müller knows all about it. He's won everything pretty much in the game, and you know, if he's feeling that way, I mean, I think Bayern, I would say if you had to call a favourite to win it, I would say Bayern.
It's interesting. Don't you think that they're helped by the fact that there's all this fanfare around Liverpool and Salah and, you know, and Real Madrid and Ronaldo, and they're literally just creeping, and obviously
Real were really poor in that second leg against Juve and very lucky to get away with it, weren't they? I think and they've not, you know, been playing well domestically this year. We saw Spurs, you know, beat them over two. You know, if that had been a knockout tie, Spurs would have won it on aggregate comfortably. I mean, they beat them well at Wembley and got a good draw in the Bernabeu, didn't they, Spurs? So they've been pretty unremarkable this year. But then again, when you've won it twice in a row, you've got the players, you can do it and know how to go.
Paul Clement told me a really interesting story about when they won it in the 93rd minute. He went into the dressing room afterwards and the cup's there and the players are posing for selfies with the trophy. But while they were doing so, he heard off to the left field, some players were getting together and they were saying, we've got to win it next year. We've got to win it next year.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary when you think about it, that, you know, they're literally minutes away from actually the great achievement of their season.
Yeah.
And they want to do it again. That tells you everything, doesn't
it? It's a Roy Keane mentality, isn't it? You know, you savour it for a few minutes and then you're kind of looking ahead to what's next. And the interesting thing about Real Madrid is that they're so far off the pace in the domestic league.
15 points behind.
Absolutely, 15 points behind. And yet they come alive in the second half of the season when the Champions League gets into the business end of the campaign. What's quite interesting is that if you look in, I was looking at the top 15 goal scorers in La Liga. Ronaldo has got 24 goals. There's no one else in the top 14. You have to get to 15th before you get to Gareth Bale with 11. Benzema, where is he? So I think he scored a handful of goals all season, and that presumably is the reason why they're looking at players like Kane again. And so he's going to be in demand in the summer. But I think as far to get to where they've got without a goal-scoring contribution of note from Benzema is quite significant. And they just, over the course and the distance, they know how to do it, you know, because they've been through the tough moments. And even though they weren't convincing against Juve, now that they've got a chance to close in on a third successive Champions League, it would be a fourth in 5 years, I think that they're quite keen to take it too.
We're talking about winning mentality here, aren't we? You can't get too many greater examples of that than Manchester United in that FA Cup semi-final on Saturday. Do we owe Jose an apology?
I don't know about that. I think he's perfectly I think he still gets plenty of plaudits, even if they're slightly backhanded compliments. And we know he's not. I was talking to a United supporter last night, and you know, he's saying, I can't pretend that I'm enjoying the style of football, but it is amazing how, you know, he does win big games still. And you know, that's what Spurs haven't got, is winning those big one-off games. They haven't got that mentality. Mourinho's team has got it. I still think that in some times they look like a, you know, too much about individuals than a unit in the way Spurs are. You know, Spurs are a great team; they're well built. I don't think he's got that at United, and I think
you know, the concerns of the Pogba are genuine. Whatever Pogba might have said at the weekend, sort of saying there's no problem with Mourinho, it did sound a bit half-hearted, all that. We know that there are problems. There are two big egos there that are clashing. There's a lot that's wrong there, but they are going to finish second. They could well win the FA Cup. They'll be favourites to win the FA Cup. They've beaten Tottenham in a game that really matters again. There's too many good players there for it to fall apart.
Yeah. Are there parallels here with the Fergie Beckham situation? Well, you know, this town ain't big enough for the both of us, you know.
Possibly. You're talking about two superstars, two players who have got huge celebrity lifestyles away from the club, two players that the manager would prefer to buckle down and also would want to show, regardless of what goes on outside, inside the dressing room, I'm the boss and I do what I do and you fit into the...
Because that's the problem. They're brands in football boots, aren't they?
Absolutely. That's a really good way of summing them up, because the reason why Pogba does what he does, and, you know, just as a side issue, it's quite funny to watch, you know, effectively middle-aged men kind of getting uptight about a young man colouring his hair or playing a bit of basketball or doing what young men do. You know, he gets cut your hair. Why? You know, what difference does that make to his football? It's a nonsense to deride Pogba for what he does, whether it's a tattoo, whether it's, you know, going to a disco, whether it's colouring his hair. It's about what he does on the football pitch, and Mourinho's job is to get the best out of
All this social media stuff and the branding thing. You know, Manchester United as a club do more of that than anyone.
Absolutely,
they're managing the commercial guy Richard Arnold is obsessed with it, and it sort of measures United's success on the amount of Facebook friends they've got or whatever.
If you look at their annual accounts, what they talk about is social media penetration.
Yeah, that's right. And when Pogba came back, it was Pogback. Hashtag Pogba, all that kind of thing. It's not a case of Pogba being this renegade who's more interested in his own profile. This is Manchester United encouraged all this. You know, that's what they're about. They're more about that than they are about winning trophies.
I think you're spot on. And I think, just to get back to your original question about do we owe Mourinho apology, Mourinho's ability to win trophies was never questioned. What was questioned was the fact that he spent a huge amount of money and the football at a club who pride themselves on an attacking, entertaining style of play was poor. It was poor to watch, being put in the shade by Manchester City. I think that was a valid criticism. I think it's still a valid criticism. And I don't think winning the FA Cup kind of takes away from the many people who have pointed out, because it's not been a vindictive criticism. It's been a criticism shared by many people whose matched experience, whether it's going to a game, whether it's watching on TV, hasn't been the same as it has been under their previous Sir Alex Ferguson's regime, I should say, rather than David Moyes or Louis van Gaal. I think that there is that. I think there's been the treatment of players. You know, not a lot of people have been particularly happy about the way Luke Shaw's been treated. There's been the superstar players that they've signed. Martial, who can't get a game, looks as though he's going to leave this season. Rashford, one of the best young talents in England, not playing regular first-team football from the start. He will tell you he's made lots of appearances, but he's not starting enough games. And Kiddo rightly pointed out, for all the attacking talents that they have, they are not scoring enough goals. So I don't think it's necessarily a question of do we owe Mourinho apology because he's got to the FA Cup final. We haven't won it yet. It's about the fact that I think the criticisms of United season, I think, are still valid for all the points they've accrued, and even despite the fact that they're going to the FA Cup final.
Last year under Van Gaal, they won the FA Cup and finished about 15 points off first place. And that's probably what they'll do this year.
You know, there's going to be an awful lot of hype in the build-up to the FA Cup final. It's going to be billed as, it's already been billed as Mourinho against Conte. So we might as well start it here. Is all the personal stuff relevant to a football match?
Do you know what? I don't think it will be, because they
there was so much antipathy between them not long before their last league meeting, but I know that there was this rapprochement in the dressing room between them before. I heard a bit about what happened behind the scenes, and they were brought together and they'd actually spoke together and they were quite respectful, and actually they piped down just before that game and since that game. I think that thing that blew up between them when they were trading insults on a daily basis seems to have died down. They don't like each other. Mourinho always got under Conte's skin, and he's always.
It was interesting because Chelsea took the initiative there, didn't they?
Yeah,
Chelsea
took
the initiative.
Yeah, and sort of got a rapprochement between the two of them. And you know, I don't think we'll have too many fireworks between the two managers. Actually, it's a shame because we all have that sort of thing, you know, as to the gaiety of a nation, doesn't it? I don't think it'll be a great final. I actually, as a complete neutral, was hoping it might be Chelsea Spurs, because Chelsea Spurs is always a great game to watch as a neutral. Chelsea Man United, I think, could be a slightly cagey one, I'm afraid.
It is interesting because the FA Cup to Pochettino would be the start of a new era. If you like, the FA Cup to Conte, it's the end of an era.
Yeah.
And I think as far as Conte is concerned, it would be a parting gift, if you like. But I do agree, there is a fascination with the fact that we'd have loved to have seen the fireworks between Conte and Mourinho, but then on the flip side, half of our own industry would be saying, oh, it's terrible, you've got two managers who are having a go at each other. So there are those two sort of sides to the same coin. But I remember, and it's worth pointing out just how bad it was, because I remember being at Norwich after the FA Cup tie, and I remember looking around and we were all open-mouthed at the ferocity with which Conte went for Mourinho and talked about him being fake and talked about him wearing the Ranieri tracksuit top with his initials on, after deriding his inability to speak English, having spent so long in the English game.
He wasn't wrong, Conte, as you could tell from the way Mourinho started heaping praise on Wenger after Wenger's retirement, as if there's always been great respect. You wouldn't understand it, you're not inside football. We had great respect for each other, despite the fact he's made some truly dreadful personal comments about Wenger, as well as the specialist in failure in the professional stuff. You know, it's been the two-facedness of Mourinho. No boundary.
And I think that would have been one of the things that, you know, Conte will have known.
Yeah.
Really great on Mourinho, him going really for the heart of the whole sort of antipathy between the two. So let's not kid ourselves that because there's been a sort of détente, if you like, that they like each other. I think
I think they'll rein it in.
Yes, I think Chelsea, I remember afterwards, you know how it works, like after the main press conference where Conte was dropping bombs, we all went outside to do a separate daily press conference, and the Chelsea press officer, Steve Atkins, basically said, we will not speak again about Mourinho. We don't want anything else about Mourinho. And he wouldn't allow anyone to kind of continue. And I think it was at that point that they may well have decided, you know, enough. And then after that, he never, you know, it was all started to cool down. I think Chelsea, you're right, they took the initiative to realise this is escalating here.
More importantly than any of this is that, you know, United signed Matic from Chelsea, and that's improved United and weakened Chelsea. And I think I wouldn't bet against Matic being man of the match in the United win at Wembley.
That could actually vindicate, if you like, Conte, in a way. You know,
because he was complaining about the transfer business.
And it's not been in the last few months. When we were in pre-season, we were sitting in a hotel with Conte, and he was telling us then, you know, I'm worried about this season. He said, I don't want to have a Mourinho season. And look, it could end with Mourinho ending his season. And so,
there'll be a bit of symmetry about that, wouldn't there?
100%. And I think as far as Matic is concerned, it's such a good call, because if Matic was still at Chelsea, they might still have had a chance of being better than they were, but he couldn't guarantee him regular first-team football.
No, he wasn't playing all the time last season, but he's still... Yeah, but I mean, he wasn't playing... Fabregas was playing alongside Kante a lot last season, wasn't he?
But that's the reason why he left, because he hadn't brought him in because he was paving the way to bring back Iyoko in, and Bakayoko's been awful.
Conte didn't want to sell him, that's for sure.
No, Conte sold him. And brought the club, Conte didn't bring him in, the club brought Bakayoko in, believing him to be the superior player, and Bakayoko's been poor.
Disastrous, really, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think Conte will leave, and I think he will be better off somewhere else where he can fit into the way a different club does it. But Chelsea see themselves to have a model that they think works for them, if they lose the FA Cup final, I think a lot of questions will be asked about that model because it's not sustainable when you consider how many clubs have overtaken them.
I just want very briefly to look at what's a sensitive issue, ticket pricing for the final. £145, £115, both those tickets up £30. Then it's £80, which is up, I think, 15. Mm. Are the FA failing in their duty of care to the fan by sanctioning that sort of rise?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I'm not a fan, as on a slightly different tangent, I'm not a fan of having semi-finals at Wembley, but that's all financial. I'm not a fan. You know, I'd like to go back to neutral grounds, and we saw a lot of empty seats at Chelsea Southampton. I don't know the exact pricing of the semi-finals, but they're not cheap. Mm. And I agree that is, you know, everyone's going to want to go to an FA Cup final. They know they've got a captive audience. They know that that's going to sell out, particularly the way they distribute tickets as well, in terms of a lot of them going to,
I think, the lowest lasers. Price ticket's £46, I think.
Yeah, sure. It's poor, but the fact is, it's not just the FA. It's clubs, it's the Premier League. You know, the paying punter, the guy who actually goes and watches the game, you know, is the lowest of priorities. And then we see that in the late changes, you know, of games for television and many other aspects. You know, the fact that the very cogent arguments that have been made for safe standing are completely dismissed by government. Mm. You know, and even things like VAR. The way that when you actually in people who actually go and watch football and pay to watch football do not want VAR more than any more, you know, that's entirely done for a TV audience, and it's entirely done with no care or thought whatsoever for the paying punter. So the pricing of the FA Cup final tickets is not a surprise, because it's part of a trend whereby the guy who actually pays, the guy or the woman and the family who go and watch their team are given less and less consideration, I'm afraid.
Mm. You know, it's interesting that this debate about ticket prices almost dovetails into the Arsenal argument, because Arsenal fans have found, and Arsene Wenger has been in the papers and at press conference talking about the fact that the fans turned their backs on me, the fans hounded me out, the fans did for me. What the fans realised was that they had no other way of making their point but to stop going to games. What did that do? That affected the image. And Wenger said it himself. You're looking around the world at Arsenal as a club and you're seeing empty seats in the Emirates Stadium. That had a negative impact. Mm. A couple of good examples of this. The away end in the Chelsea-Southampton game yesterday. That's at the away end. The Southampton end. Mm. Empty. What, fully 25 or half empty by 20-25 minutes before the end. Ipswich, where the crowds were down to 10,000-13,000 before Mick McCarthy revealed he was going to go this weekend. First game since his announcement at 20,000. You know, fans are realising the only way to make their point, if they can't influence the decision making of authority or of club owners, is to stay away, because they know that's the only way to make their point. And
I think it has made a difference at Arsenal as well. I think it really could have been the straw that broke the camel's back with Wenger, actually, that it was the empty seats for that amount of games with so many empty seats.
Yeah, you were at the press conference yesterday. Mm. Give me a sense of the mood there. I thought Paul Hayward from The Telegraph came out with a great line where he talked about this being Arsene Wenger's Captain Oates moment. I'm just going outside for a moment. Might be some time.
Taking one for the team, yeah.
What was the mood like?
It was a strange. It was a strange atmosphere at the match. I think most of us went there expecting there to be an outpouring of emotion and support from the Arsenal fans towards Wenger. Now he's gone, because I think everyone, I'm sure they do, appreciate what he achieved, even if it was back in the mists of time. But there was very little of that. There was very little. It was the atmosphere at the match, apart from the fact that it was more or less. It was much fuller than it had been. There were more people there than there would have been. But the actual atmosphere, it just felt like a nothing end of season game for Arsenal. It was important for West Ham, but it didn't feel like there was a special sense of occasion. Wenger, but Wenger had decided, because Wenger doesn't want to go. We know that. What the semantics are about how much he jumped and how much he was pushed.
he didn't want to go, and that became obvious. But he was quite adamant he didn't want to answer any questions about why he went or how the decision was made. But then he did actually, you know, in the written press conference, he did begin to sort of slightly, you know, buckle and did sort of start to actually tell us some quite interesting stuff, and the idea that he clearly wants to continue managing, but he's doesn't think he'd be able emotionally to deal with managing against Arsenal, because there is an intriguing possibility of Everton, which, you know, with money, he has connections to them. Everton is the one that, and it's probably the best Premier League job he could get this summer would be Everton. That is the one. And you just wonder if Everton pushed the boat out money-wise, whether he might be tempted, but he reckoned no.
It was funny.
But also, the main thing, just one final thing, sure, was that he... You could tell the hurt of the man, and on a personal level, despite the fact I think he should have gone 2 or 3 years ago, he's got pretty warm feelings for him. Everyone who's met him, you can't dislike Wenger. It's very difficult to dislike Wenger. But he was hurt and felt betrayed, and that was, and he you know, talked about the fans, the lack of unity, ruining the image of the club, and it was clear that that had hurt him. He started to try and rein back almost a little bit, but it was clear that it really has wounded him.
I was going to make a different point, but I do just want to agree with what you're saying about, regardless of what you might think about when he should have gone, it has hurt. I remember the Manchester City game, and City were ripping Arsenal apart. The stadium was half empty, Arsene Wenger's in the dugout, helpless. Knowing that
there was a real sense of embarrassment that night, wasn't it?
Absolutely, because he was well aware that had he gone to the edge of his technical area, he'd have been a lightning rod for, you know, they'd have all got stuck into him, the home fans. The away fans had taken a mickey out of him. This is a great man of great dignity, distinction, done massive, magnificent things for the club. But it was sad to see that happen. It was sad to see him in that predicament. And it was even more sad that he didn't want to let go of it, despite all of that, and that the decision was taken out of his hands. And Ivan Gazidi's been talking about a bold appointment, a way forward, all this speculation about who's going to take over.
Can we look at the runners and riders here? Because I've got a hunch they might do a Wenger too, i.e. go for someone young, maybe a bit left field. Nagelsmann is the obvious one. And, you know, someone told me that Josh Kroenke really wanted to get a young coach in.
Look, there's 2 points on that. If you look around European football, with the exception of Allegri's 50, Klopp's 50, a lot of the top managers in European football are in their 40s. Enrique's 47, Conte's 48. Who else is there? Jardim is 43. Arteta's 36, and he's now being talked about as the next bright young thing of management as well.
Interesting that Vieira ruled himself out.
Vieira's 48. It is interesting he's ruled himself out, because I
personally... Yeah, he rules himself out because he thinks he's not going to get it.
He's not going to get it. That's right.
That's the problem. Way everything works,
and the thing is about the football grapevine, as you know more than anyone, is that it's very, very closed, but there's some news filters around within it, and he would have got wind of the fact that I'd be staggered if they don't already know their man. Listen, Gazidi's brought in 9 new department heads last summer, including Sven Mislintat as the head of recruitment, and Raul Sanele, I hope I got that pronunciation right, the head of international relations. He brought Enrique to Barcelona. He was instrumental in signing Suarez.
The obvious favourite.
Enrique, absolutely.
That personal connection. Weirdly, Enrique's record when he hasn't got Lionel Messi in the team, which he won't have at Arsenal, is very average. He had a season at Roma where they finished mid-table. Yep. He left. He had a season at Celta Vigo. Obviously not a big club, but did nothing special there either. So his track record when he hasn't got Lionel Messi...
And actually, the inheritance isn't great, is it?
He did a very good job at Barcelona. He did.
Well, I was going to say, that's how they would sell it. I mean, it was a good piece by Johnny Moorcroft.
They're not going to have to sell it too hard. I mean, it's, you know, he's a big name. And the interesting thing, I thought, we had a poll in our paper of Arsenal fans, and there were like 10 names. And I think the highest one, I can't remember who actually was highest, but it was about 18%. There's no groundswell of opinion about any one candidate. There's no real popular choice. There's no one that's sweeping the board in
fans' polls.
Do you
know, I think that might well be because they simply wanted Wenger out. It wasn't...
They didn't have anyone in mind. There's no real... I personally would go for
Ancelotti, I would go for the opposite of what they're likely to go for, because I think that it's wrong now to try and do what, in a way, what United did after Ferguson, yes, was think we're going to get the next guy in to build the next dynasty. Doesn't happen like that. Certainly won't happen like that after someone's been in charge as long as Wenger. What they need is, I think, a good, solid, short-term appointment
to two get seasons. Them
through what's... Yeah, and Ancelotti would be perfect for that, I think. He knows the league, he'll do well, and he would be a calming influence on a club, which is it's going to be, despite the fact so many people inside the club hierarchy and in the stands wanted him out, it's going to feel like a bereavement. It's going to feel very strange for Arsenal after 22 years of the same man who's almost built this club into a new club. The godfather of everything he surveyed would have gone. That I think that they don't want to be looking for another long-term vision, because it's not going to happen.
Yeah, but don't you think there's a big difference in so much as David Moyes went and he changed too much?
Yeah.
You guys like Muhlenstein and Phelan, and you know, he just got them all out and didn't realise that these guys were all key figures behind the scenes. And I think, you know, getting the people at Arsenal that they have done into the club to spend a year there. I mean, I think they will have got there, if it is going to be Enrique, they'd have told him 6 months ago, you know, probably a year ago, when they signed Aubameyang. I think it's inconceivable that they wouldn't have sold it to him by saying, you know what, the manager may well be going in the summer, you know, and we are going to get... And it's, okay, I'll come, you know. And I think that there will have been time for the new man to
An exact parallel between United and Arsenal, by the way. They are doing things differently and better. And obviously, when Ferguson left, there was no structure in place. He was just one man who was a genius, and he left, and there was very little, you know, any sort of infrastructure in terms of the way the club was managed for Moyes to take over. And that's not going to be quite the case at Arsenal. They have been building a new structure around Wenger. Well, you know,
it was because he was talking about the catalyst for change and the fact
not
that
not really been that has he?
They've finished outside the top four, and Gazidis has literally been rebuilding the club around him, and he's been sort of standing in there in the middle of it, saying, "No, I'm still in charge."
Can they say goodbye to him by winning the Europa League?
They can do, but I'm worried about Atletico Madrid, because I think they're up against, again, another manager who knows how to inspire his players, who can get the best out of him, whose side a better balance than Arsenal. Yes, Costa's not going to be fit for the first leg. He'll play in the second leg, and I think, you know, even if it is away from home, you know, he's gone to Arsenal and ripped them up before, and I think there's still Griezmann to worry about. There's so many other players within the Atletico Madrid team that can hurt Arsenal. Yes, I mean, I watched a quarterfinal game. I watched them in the round before that. They've looked decent going forward, but at the back, they're all over the place. And I think that's an Atletico. Listen, when they drew Atletico Madrid, even the most staunch Arsenal fan will admit to having a sinking feeling, because that's the team they did not want. Yeah. And if they are going to win this, in a way, this is their final in some respects. So if they get past Atletico Madrid, then yeah, I think they'll win it.
Although Arsenal won 4-1 against West Ham yesterday, I didn't get the impression that there was some massive groundswell amongst the team. Oh. We've got to do this for Arsenal. They were poor until the last eight minutes when they scored three goals. West Ham could easily have won yesterday. The only way Arsenal are going to beat Atletico is with this almost superhuman sort of feeling, like, you know, of doing it for Arsenal. I didn't get the impression that that sort of feeling exists from the fans or the more importantly the players.
Can I just make a point on Everton? I know Killer mentioned Everton. Mashiri at Everton is obsessed with celebrity. He's just, you know, I remember he gave an interview, a radio interview, when he said, the Northwest is Hollywood and we need to get a Hollywood manager in. It would not surprise me at all if Mashiri were to go for Wenger, because he could turn around and say to the fans who are unhappy with Sam Allardyce, and I think the way they've treated him with that ridiculous survey is reprehensible.
Crazy, wouldn't it?
But I think they will try to seduce them by saying, we're going to try and get Arsene Wenger in. And if Wenger does want to stay in the Premier League, I agree, that could well be the one place he'll end up.
So, Dave, was Mauricio Pochettino signalling his availability?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he floated on a couple of occasions the idea of him or another manager. He just floated it out there. I think I've had a feeling, I mentioned it after they lost to Juventus, that he's not that young. He's been 10 years as a manager. He's never won a trophy. And at some point, he's going to want to win a trophy. I don't believe
what he's always said about not caring about the FA Cup that much and it not really being that important. It is important. It is important that Tottenham haven't won a trophy for 10 years. It's important that Pochettino hasn't won a trophy, I think, 9 years as a manager. And he's going to want to do that because he's a very, very good manager. He's done an outstanding job there. I do think, and I've said it before, and I do think there is a one weakness with Pochettino is that he doesn't work well with experienced players who have their own opinions. He doesn't deal with that situation well. We've seen that again with Alderweireld, and he may lose a couple of his most experienced players, Alderweireld, Dembele. Rose is slightly different. He's been injured, but he may well also leave for the same reasons. Walker, it happened last year. So there is a slight problem of man management with Pochettino that could be his Achilles heel.
Yeah. This ties in with one of the questions we've got from the listeners and the viewers. Ian Hamilton asks, Darren, after 4 years of progress but no trophies, how long before the penny drops? Are we going too far with praise for Pochettino?
I don't think we are, because you have to remember the state that Spurs were in before he arrived. They were basically up against the glass, peering through at the big clubs dining at the top table. They now, if they cement their place in the top four this season, they'll have been in there for three consecutive seasons. He's changed the mentality at the club. He's changed the consistency at the club. He's developed Harry Kane. He's turned Wembley into a fortress for them, by and large, when many people thought that it could be the reason for them not finishing in the top four again. So, no, I don't think we're going overboard at all. You've got to look at the club's net spend in relation to the teams around them. You've got to look at the fact that Arsenal have spent substantially more, so too Chelsea, and they are not in the top four. I think that you have to praise him. Kiddo's absolutely right. The point of football is about winning things. But you can also recognise the progress that an individual has made at the club.
I agree with you. I'm not making a particular criticism of Pochettino saying he should have won trophies. It's difficult to win trophies in England. There's five clubs with a substantially wealthier than Spurs. But what I'm saying is Pochettino may want to go elsewhere to win trophies if he doesn't feel he can win them at Tottenham. It's not a criticism of Pochettino as such. It's more...
Dave, you know, immediately after Wembley, Spurs were called chokers, they were called bottlers. Is that fair?
It's a bit harsh, but say those two games, Juventus and United at Wembley, the games that lost them the Champions League and the FA Cup, they were ahead in both of those games and ended up losing 2-1. And there was an element of that they froze a little. And there is a feeling that quite often in one-off games, they don't quite do it. I mean, I thought winning at Chelsea was a really big deal for them, and that was one of those hurdles they really overcame. And I thought that might be when they won at Chelsea. I thought, wow, they may go on and win the cup this year as well as finishing top four, and then that's good. That's a great season for me for Spurs. But that, you know, they didn't follow it through, and United had the mentality that Spurs didn't have.
But when the listener is talking about the question, is the praise going overboard? That too is a key thing. Winning at Spurs for the first time in 20 years, winning at Chelsea, ending the hoodoo, the stranglehold that Arsenal had over them. Yeah. This will be the first time in successive seasons, I think since the 80s, that they'll have finished above Arsenal. I think you can't praise what he's done enough. The final thing would be winning trophies. I concede that absolutely.
He's done a really good job, but he may want to win trophies elsewhere. That's my point.
And I think they'll want to spend money and they'll want to get better players in, or he'll want to be at a club where when you do have top players, you pay them what they're worth, because that's the big bugbear with Rose and with Alderweireld. Mm.
We've touched on this slightly, but I do think it's a question just worth returning to. Vernon Grant asks, are the Arsenal fans who went on strike hypocrites, or are they trendsetters? Should disgruntled supporters of other teams vote with their feet?
I don't think they're hypocrites, as I was saying before. Initially I did, but I'll make the distinction. I think the ones that had been battering Wenger for a long time and then suddenly, since the announcement, have been on social media and elsewhere sort of saying, oh, no, don't criticise him, he's a great man. Yeah, I've got no time for that. But I think the ones who actually took the difficult decision to miss out on good games, the City games, people were basically, oh, they'll come back if they get into the quarterfinals of the of the Europa League. They didn't. They'll come back if they get into the semi-finals. They may do now, but judging by yesterday and the fact that some still stayed away, they're still not, won over just yet. I think, as I said before, for fans right now, they have so few ways to make their point. I think at Arsenal, at Ipswich, at Southampton, I think they're all the tip of the iceberg. Supporters are realising the only way to make your point is by not giving clubs your money. People have said, say they pay their season ticket money, yeah, but they didn't go and spend money in the bars. They didn't, you know, the pies, this, that.
Season
they
weren't. Tickets, I don't think were great either.
Absolutely. I think that fans are realising that they have that financial power that can hurt clubs, and maybe those Arsenal fans might well be the start of something that sort of bigger that we'll see in football in the English game.
It is a strange old stadium and a slightly strange support. I can't generalise, but there's no other stadium in the Premier League where we had the first 10 minutes and the last 10 minutes of each half, people wandering in and out, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of walking past you, going off to get a pie or a Coke or whatever. Yeah, or a tube. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah. There is nowhere else like it. It's just genuinely true. Arsenal, there is quite a lot of Arsenal fans who do treat it more like a trip to the cinema or something than that.
You get that announcement, don't you? The second half is about to start.
Yeah, and then about a quarter of an hour later,
they'll turn up, yeah. Just a final point. PFA Awards last night. Mo Salah over Kevin De Bruyne. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. If you can't get the PFA, the Player of the Year Award for scoring 31 goals, 41 in total, when are you going to get it? As a winger as well. You know, when are you going to win it? Yes, De Bruyne has been fabulous, but I still maintain if you take De Bruyne out of that team, he probably still would win the league. Probably not by as far, but they would win the league. I think if Salah isn't in that Liverpool team, they're mid-table and they're nowhere near the Champions League semi-finals. I think that Salah is a fabulous footballer.
I can't argue with Salah. I voted for De Bruyne, but I cannot argue with Salah. It's so close. I love watching De Bruyne. I almost felt like it had to be a City player because City has been so good this season. I know it's an individual award. I can see both sides of it. I was really torn, but I went for De Bruyne.
Mm. Well, I voted for Salah in the FWA Awards. I've also got a hunch that Leroy Sané, the PFA's Young Player of the Year, will win the big one next year. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.